ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Jules and Jez here. Join us as we unpack the news of the week on Not Stupid.
Greenland is depicted the same size as Africa, but Africa is 14 times the size.
A lot bigger than the Mercator map shows.
And I wonder if Donald Trump knows that Greenland is not that big.
You can find Not Stupid on the ABC Listen app.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. The Nevada desert was an interesting place to be in the 1950s.
Night falls swiftly at Desert Rock, the tension and the excitement mounting.
On a clear night in 1951, US Army troops from the 11th Airborne Division excitedly took their seats in the desert just outside Las Vegas.
H-hour minus 2 minutes. Minus 2 minutes. All personnel kneel down in the trenches.
They would soon be the first group of soldiers to witness a nuclear explosion.
You are here to participate in an atomic maneuver.
The soldiers sat on the desert sand, their backs to the bomb so they weren't blinded by the flash. You can actually see the flash reflected off their backs. Now, it seems a little counterintuitive for an army to drive a bunch of soldiers to watch a nuclear explosion close range. But the reason they had been brought along was to prepare them for what it would be like to encounter atomic weapons on the battlefield.
You can live through an atomic attack, and by taking common sense precautions, live to fight another day.
They didn't want the soldiers to be shocked by the shockwave, which should be arriving right about now. Tests like this prompted the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, a group set up by Albert Einstein, J. Robert Oppenheimer, and other scientists who'd worked on the development of nuclear weapons, to launch something they called the Doomsday Clock. It was a visual representation of how close they thought humanity was to a man-made global catastrophe. Initially, it was set at 7 minutes to midnight, but a few years later, by the mid-1950s...
A few weeks ago, the Doomsday Clock was advanced to 2 minutes to midnight.
Now, as of this year, 2026...
It is now 85 seconds to midnight. This is the closest the world has ever been to midnight.
Now, the thing that interests me about this is this clock has been telling us that we are seconds from global catastrophe for nearly 80 years.
Ironically, the Doomsday Clock as an image does the opposite to what its intent would be.
That's Steven Pinker, the internationally renowned cognitive psychologist and science writer. He really doesn't like this clock, particularly because the point of it is to make us think that we can act to stop Armageddon.
A clock just ticks down. You know, unless you smash the clock, it's going to keep going. So the clock is really a rather awful metaphor for the idea that our future is in our hands.
And yet the clock has been wound back on occasion. It's like adjusting your clock back an hour after daylight saving time ends, except you adjust it backwards 17 minutes when the Cold War ends.
To their credit, they did that, but generally they try to move it closer and closer, and their problem now is they're running out of room.
It's just a few seconds to midnight, and yet we've had no nuclear attacks, no World War III. In fact, in the 8 decades the clock has been running, for the most part, things are kind of just better than ever. Extreme poverty across the globe has dropped by 40%. Child mortality has dropped from 1 in 4 children dying before they reach 15 to 1 in 20. Global life expectancy has risen by nearly 30 years. The world has objectively become a much better place to live, and yet, tick-tock, doom continues to approach.
They switched the definition of doomsday, so it was no longer thermonuclear war, but now it was overpopulation and resource shortages and climate change. So they found some new reasons that we're all doomed.
And look, yes, I can sense you shouting, what about climate change? How does that fit into your objectively much better world? It's a good question and a good point. If we factor in the rise of global temperatures, I also feel that sense of doom, and I'm not alone.
Let's talk more about climate anxiety.
Climate change is here, it is terrifying, and it is just the beginning.
In the future, it's going to be even worse. Earth is not going to be livable for us.
The future feels ominous. And yet, as we've shown over the last few episodes, we're generally really bad at predicting what the future is going to look like. So is this any different? I'm Matt Bevan, and from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans. In this, the final episode, I want to tackle doom and figure out why, despite our constant feeling that it's coming, it still hasn't. The thing that started us on this journey was this.
Hello there, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, John, I can hear you.
Are you getting me loud and clear?
Yes, loud and clear.
I hope so. I'll have to get on now anyway. I haven't time to wait, so I'll assume that somehow or other you've tuned in.
Ah, yes, that's right. He can't hear me. It's in 1959 and I can only make time flow in one direction. John Horner's letter is one of 19 letters to the unborn, recorded by ABC Radio in Adelaide, addressed to us in the future. As John was writing, the doomsday clock was set at 2 minutes to midnight. And like many of the letter writers, he was unsure whether anyone would even exist in the future to open the letters.
Our chances of survival on this earth of your forefathers are not quite as rosy as they might be. Once upon a time, it was difficult to kill more than one person with one weapon at one pop. By 1945, the number had improved to 100,000. Today, it is said to run into millions, and it seems that a global war could very well wipe us all out in a very short time.
Adelaide poet Max Harris expected that we in the future would look back on 1959 with bemusement.
We 1959ers live in the shadow of the hydrogen bomb and some world-destroying war of nuclear fission. It's an uneasy, strange sort of life we lead back here.
At the time, people all over the world were truly terrified of the prospect of nuclear war.
Where are you from?
Originally from New York, but I'm living in Sydney now.
Why did you come here in the first place?
Well, our main reason for coming to Australia was to get away from the pressure of nuclear business and the Cold War. At the time, I was pregnant, and we were very afraid of fallout, and I didn't want to bring up my children under that kind of physical danger.
Max Harris thought that the only way disaster could be averted would be through some kind of global brainwashing program.
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000. The price of this great and ultimate good has been the faculty of criticism in every individual. You say it's a small price to pay for the world's peace. Set against the possibility of a world-destroying, say, cobalt bomb, your argument's irrefutable.
And yet, here we are, most of us still unbrainwashed, at least as far as I know, and not victims of a nuclear war. Some would argue that the fact that we're all still here is just down to luck. After all, there are a lot of hands hovering over a lot of big red buttons. The Americans have theirs.
Rehearsing World War III at a missile base in South Dakota. It is not known how many warheads are assigned to Moscow, but Desmond Ball says there are 60 targets within the city limits.
And the Russians have one too.
To answer nuclear attack by destroying America's leadership, military, and economy in one massive obliterating blow.
At any moment, missiles could be on their way.
Shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
It's no wonder the letter writers were worried. There have been a number of close calls. 3 years after our letters were written, there was a week-long standoff over whether the Soviet Union should be allowed to station nuclear missiles in Cuba.
It will be the most frightening week the world has known since the end of World War II.
On the 27th of October 1962, a US Navy ship dropped a number of small explosives into the water near a Soviet submarine in an attempt to get it to surface. The captain thought that World War III had started and began preparing to launch a nuclear torpedo. His executive officer, Vasily Arkhipov, stopped him. Two other close calls seem to have been caused by the Aurora Borealis. The same day as the Russian submarine almost launched a nuclear torpedo, an American spy plane pilot was trying to navigate his way across the Arctic using the stars, but couldn't see them because of the aurora. He ended up over Siberia, almost triggering a dogfight between Russian and American fighter jets, but he escaped Soviet airspace before being intercepted. Another close call in 1995 was somehow also caused by the Aurora Borealis.
This is the rocket that sent Moscow into a spin.
A Norwegian research rocket launched to study the Northern Lights was mistaken for a ballistic missile by the Soviet early warning system.
The panic in Moscow sent shockwaves through Western capitals.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin said he opened the black suitcase, which is carried with him at all times, and has communications equipment inside which can be used to order a nuclear strike, but he decided not to use it. The US president also has a briefcase like this.
Wherever the president is, the trigger of nuclear policy, the briefcase is always near, containing not a button, but the day's go codes, which are supposed to offer him a variety of nuclear wars to fight.
What happens at a state dinner between the US and Russia? Are they all sitting around chatting amicably while both the briefcase guys sit awkwardly in opposing corners? Wait, I just had an amazing idea for a romance novel. The two briefcase guys exchange glances across a nuclear summit and fall in love. Sorry, I'm getting sidetracked. Both sides have seen their share of false alarms, but have always identified them just in time and refused to retaliate. Or at least that's certainly the impression you get by watching movies. Vasily Arkhipov, the Soviet submarine officer who stopped the launch of that nuclear missile in 1962, has been portrayed in Hollywood film adaptations by both Denzel Washington and Liam Neeson.
200 million Soviet citizens are depending on us to save them from nuclear attack.
Yes, that's Liam Neeson attempting a Russian accent. Nuclear close calls have been one of the most common shortcuts to drama in movies, TV, and books for decades. Post-nuclear apocalypse fiction is one of the most popular genres out there. Oh, wait. Mutually Assured Attraction. Perfect name for the book. Someone write that down. Oh, don't push my button. So, while watching old news coverage of this issue, I came across an interesting perspective from the strategic studies expert Dr. Jeffrey Lee Williams in 1981.
Well, I think there's an obsession with the kind of impact that any kind of war would have on society. And given developments in nuclear technology, this is a well-founded, rational fear.
So fear of war is rational, but...
Undoubtedly, it's been exaggerated because the Western powers have developed theories of deterrence. And to deter war, you maximize the impact that war would have, or at least you create the impression that war would be of a disastrous character.
Let me just take this opportunity to close the hatch to my underground recording bunker. So part of the theory of deterring nuclear war is that you make everyone so terrified of it that nobody would ever actually push the button. You create a ridiculously big nuclear arsenal, then tell everyone how terrible it would be if anyone ever used that nuclear arsenal, therefore making it very unlikely that it will ever be used. Fear is part of the system. The less we fear it, the more likely it is to happen, and vice versa. The very existence of the doomsday clock makes it less likely that it will ever reach midnight, at least in theory. Let's look at this on a smaller scale.
20 years ago, computer memory limits forced programmers to shorten the year stamp to two numbers. But come 2000, computers won't understand 00. They'll stop.
Remember this? The threat of the millennium bug?
Anything with a date timer is at risk. Airport controls, traffic lights, the power supply, payrolls, the office lift. The list is endless.
The experts were very convinced that at midnight on the 1st of January 2000, the world's computers were going to go haywire.
Type 00 into your computer. Press enter. I dare you.
What happens?
It stops working.
What's predicted is financial chaos, transport chaos, infrastructure collapse, even global recession.
And governments around the world took it seriously.
It is a complex test that requires us all to work together. Every government agency, every university, every hospital, every business, large and small.
Worldwide, Y2K bug preparations have cost several hundred billion dollars.
And then, when the clock struck midnight and the new millennium began...
There were no massive blackouts, no planes falling from the sky, no nuclear meltdowns.
Learned that we did have a cash register that refused to process receipts in Okinawa.
A lot of people thought the whole thing had been a scam.
I think a lot of people made a lot of money out of it all.
I think what happened was we had the emergence of what I term the Y2K entrepreneur, dedicated to building this thing up as much as they could, milking it for the maximum that they possibly could.
Computer analyst Graham Bond said that while the problem was real, it could have been dealt with much more cheaply if there'd been less hype.
And so instead of these things being treated in a sensible way by the people that operated and understood the equipment, those people got sidelined, bring in the external consultants, and vast amounts of money were expended.
But here's the question. Was fear of disaster a key reason that disaster was averted? Without fear of the nuclear apocalypse or climate disaster or AI going rogue and killing us all, would we make those things more likely to happen? Strategic Studies Professor Jeffrey Lee Williams didn't think so. He said that he thought exaggerating the threat of nuclear war was a mistake.
And in the end, it becomes self-defeating. Because it makes any kind of provision by way of protective measures for the population seem irrational, unnecessary, even dangerous.
So if nuclear Armageddon is inevitable, what's the point in taking actions to prevent it? Cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker has been thinking about this for a long time, and so I wanted to ask him about it. Steven, is overstating the risk of doom likely to make us give up?
I think that really is a danger, that if you pile on the doomsday scenarios, if nuclear war doesn't wipe us all out, then climate change will, and if that doesn't, then it'll be rogue artificial intelligence. At some point, people would just say, to hell with it, if we're doomed, may as well enjoy life now. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
Bill Gates, who I know is a big fan of yours, Stephen, recently made a lot of headlines with some comments on climate change. He says climate change will have serious consequences, particularly for people in the poorest countries. It will not lead to humanity's demise. People will be able to live and thrive in most places on Earth for the foreseeable future. Do you think that statements like this, even if they're accurate, undermine the efforts to decarbonize the economy?
It's at least as likely that people will, in fact, be more receptive to decarbonization if they, first of all, think that it's not a question of whether we're doomed, which is not to say that we can relax. We definitely can. Bad things could happen. Bad things will happen unless we decarbonize. But we've got to adjust the balance of decarbonization so it doesn't keep poor people in extreme poverty.
Bill Gates' argument is effectively that preventing people in developing countries from improving their standard of living using fossil fuels would be more harmful to them than the expected effects of climate change. And he points out that we're already on our way to dramatically decreasing our emissions without dramatically changing our lifestyle. Do you ever try and predict the future, Stephen?
I am leery of making predictions, although I'm willing to talk about possibilities.
In my career, I've had some role in covering 18 elections and referendums. And if going grey by my early 30s is any indication, they have taken their toll. I don't make predictions, at least not publicly. But if you'd forced me to make one a couple of months before each one of these votes, I would have got it right 9 out of 18 times. You might as well flip a coin. And yet I somehow still cover elections professionally. Weird. Among our letter writers, several made predictions about something within their own field of expertise. Professor Norval Morris, a world-famous criminologist, foresaw the end of the use of prisons as a punishment for crimes.
As I see it, prison as a punishment started in the Walnut Street Jail in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in 1790. It's clearly on the decline now, and seems likely, apart from a few vestigial remains, to disappear before 1990.
Dr. Brian Elliott, the great champion of Australian literature, predicted that the royal family would decide to leave London for greener pastures.
Would it be so surprising if the new royal residence should be situated in that delightful, beautiful and highly cultured metropolis, uncontaminated by any intrusion of sordid or commercial industrial pettiness, Canberra, the nation's, nay, the Commonwealth's capital?
Alec Ramsey, the architect of modern Adelaide, predicted that things would only get better in the future.
In my lifetime, and it's not been all that long as yet, the strides science and engineering have made make it seem quite certain that unless we blow ourselves up for political reasons, we shall, by the end of this century, have no more economic troubles.
Well, we do still have a few economic troubles, but on average, there really has never been a better time to be a human than right now. It's just that a lot of the time it doesn't feel like it. And Steven Pinker says part of that is because we don't really report on it.
So a lot of progress is invisible. It either consists of things that haven't happened that therefore don't make the news, like parts of the world that are at peace. Also, some of the progress that's taken place creeps up a few percentage points a year, such as the decline in extreme poverty, the increase in longevity. And so, once again, it doesn't happen on a Thursday in October at 9:17 a.m., and so it's not news. A news feed is bound to overrepresent the negative.
In breaking news, you didn't die today.
There's a gravitas, a kind of seriousness that comes with pointing out the negative. You seem more like a prophet, whereas to point out the progress, you seem more like an apologist or naive.
Of the 20 people the ABC asked to write a letter in 1959, just one was a woman. In her letter, Ellen Christensen talked about the two types of predictions about the future. One epitomised by people like George Orwell,
who describe your age in terms of mechanisation, standardisation, exploitation and annihilation. Well, if the Orwell point of view is correct, you won't be here to find the letter.
And the other by people who predict a labour-free utopia,
in which no work is done by man. It is the age of automation. Machines make machines and work them.
But Ellen Christensen said that she wasn't really interested in what the circumstances of our life were.
I'm not interested in the material man-made world in which you live. That's ephemeral and immaterial. I am interested in what sort of person, what sort of individual you are, in how you feel when you're alone with yourself. On the personal side, in any period of history, the experience of life is surely much the same.
Her idea was that the experience of being a human doesn't really change all that much.
I have friends amongst the Trojan women and the Canterbury Pilgrims, though they're much further away from me in time and external circumstances than you are.
The thing is, I'm certain Ellen Christensen is right. The reason we know this is we decided to redo the letter-writing experiment ourselves. But right now, in 2026, we asked a number of Australian luminaries to give us some letters written to their great-grandchildren to file away with the letters from 1959.
Hello, I'm Geraldine Doogue, bringing you a letter to the future.
Hi, I'm Ray Johnston. I'm a STEM journalist and broadcaster.
Hi, g'day from Dr. Carl to our dear descendants at the end of the 21st century.
Chinguala, my name is Vanessa Turnbull-Roberts. I'm a human rights lawyer and advocate for children and young people.
I'm Natalie Kiriakou. I'm an environmentalist, charity director, and I'm the author of Nature's Last Dance, Tales of Wonder in an Age of Extinction.
My dear great-great-grandchildren, your welfare is constantly on my mind.
Neuroscientist Alan Finkel wrote that the civil unrest unfolding right now on the streets doesn't bode well for the future.
The COVID-19 pandemic, political polarisation, a multiplicity of wars, the pervasive influence of tech companies and the erratic executive orders of the US president have undermined our sense of peace and steady progress.
Reverend Tim Costello also had grave concerns for what could be in store.
I see a world trembling between hope and despair. We faced ecological collapse, widening inequality, and a loss of faith in shared truth.
For many of the letter writers, it was difficult to see beyond the noise and imagine a quieter, more peaceful time.
We are fed a constant stream of other people's thoughts.
Everything hums at once, drowning out the quieter hum of the land. It's the byproduct of a civilization wired too tightly to rest.
I imagine you now, in 2090, beneath the sky, carrying the weight of our choices. We were warned, you know, but it didn't stop what was coming.
While our 1959 letter writers were writing in the shadow of a nuclear winter, our present-day writers, like climate activist Anjali Sharma, are fearful of a planet rendered unlivable by climate change.
In my youth, I have been so incredibly lucky. I have seen the Great Barrier Reef, skied through mountains of snow. I have swum in oceans alive with colour and hiked through forests alive with birdsong. And it terrifies me that by the time you're old enough to ask about these things, I don't know what will remain.
We scrape mountains bare for cobalt and lithium. We pump rivers through cooling towers.
My personal estimate is that in your time, the global average temperature will be 3 degrees above the 1850 to 1900 average, with major consequences of bushfires and extreme weather conditions. I wish you good fortune in your adaptation to these conditions.
They weren't only worried about climate change.
There will be a rise in white supremacy, and the only way to combat this is to defend. Defend hard, and to not be afraid to speak up.
The thing that I cannot begin to conceive is the role of artificial intelligence in your world. If it continues to develop at the explosive rate of the last few years, artificial superintelligence, and indeed the singularity, will have been reached many decades before you were born.
The world's richest and most powerful people insist a machine with a mind like ours waits just beyond the next upgrade, because there's profit in pretending it might.
But despite all this, much like our letter writers from 1959, they were cautiously hopeful for the future.
You are the kind that insists the world can change, that refuses to stop until it does. You see devastation and you act. You see injustice and you rage. You see beauty and you protect it. You know that hope is not passive.
My faith taught me that every person bears the image of God, even those we find hardest to love. For faith, at its best, is not about walls or creeds. It's about the refusal to give up on each other.
If you are listening, I need you to know, feel, and honour that we are in the dreaming and looking after you, just like my nan, parents, and grandparents are.
I encourage you, believe that there is always a better way, and that even in a world dominated by artificial intelligence and social media, personal initiative will be rewarded. Please direct your efforts not merely to earning income, but also to helping to improve the state of your society, your friends and family.
You might be glad to know that once again, a future with instant teleportation gets a mention.
Towards the end of this century, you'll say, come in and have lunch, because thanks to the discoveries of physics, we are like gods. And after lunch, let's teleport to London.
There's no doubt that a lot will change in the next 67 years, but hopefully amongst the blur, some things will remain the same.
When you think of us, your ancestors, forgive our failings, but carry forward our longing that the human story, for all its pain, may be rich with compassion and justice. Believe in yourselves. I believe in you. Sure, I got so emotional then.
And you know what? The kookaburras will still compete with the magpies, as they are in my garden as I'm composing these thoughts. And they will, I hope, for you too. I do hope a lot of you are still gardening.
The black swan phenomenon basically makes predicting the future pointless. I can't tell you what the world is going to be like in 2027, let alone 2090. But I think Ellen Christensen is right. While black swans can radically change the circumstances around you, being a human is always the same.
What we make of life depends always on the same factors and our reactions to them, on nature, man, God, and fate, and on the extent of our own talent, skill, energy, courage, and generosity.
And who could have predicted that? This series of If You're Listening was written by me, Matt Bevan. It was produced by Adair Shepherd, Caroline Gates, Pat Sunderland, and Jess O'Callaghan. Supervising producer is Cara Jensen-McKinnon. So I actually chatted to Steven Pinker for considerably longer than the 4 or so minutes that we have included in this show. And on Tuesday, we're going to be bringing you that entire conversation. I'll see you then.